Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Continuing with campaign number one, the Battle of Lexington and Concord, entitled Let It Be Here. We pick up the story with the British having left Boston on their way to Concord to seize supplies of the Patriots, encountering Minutemen in Lexington with a skirmish, and then continuing on to Concord. It's April 19th, 1775. Colonel James Barrett of the Patriots gave the order for the men to load their muskets and prepare to march into Concord. Officers took their posts with the units and informed them of the mission, and Colonel Barrett's order not to fire their weapons unless the regulars at the bridge fired first. Major John Buttrick ordered his battalion of Minutemen to face to the right in a column of two files. When he commanded the companies forward, they stepped off with the acting company of Captain Isaac Davis first. As the mounted Colonel Barrett watched them pass, he kept repeating his order not to fire first. With drums beating the cadence and fifers playing Walk Cockade, Colonel Barrett's troops marched down the hill to the riverbank, then left onto a causeway that carried the road through the marsh, which was inundated when the river overflowed its banks with the recent spring freshets. Robinson, Buttrick, and Davis marched near the head of the column as it approached the bridge. The British officers were impressed by the regularity with which the colonial militia advanced. Lorry ordered all his men to the east bank and directed one company into the adjacent fields to the left and right of the road, and the other two companies to form for street fighting and to prepare to fire by divisions. In this manner, the men in the first rank would fire a volley, then retire to the rear of the formation to reload as the second rank stepped forward to fire, and the process repeated throughout the entire formation. While the tactic maintained continuous firing, the fire was directed on a narrow front. As they waited for the Americans to draw closer, Lowry the British ordered some men to remove the planks from the bridge, which might slow the Americans, but would also strand British Officer Parr's detachment on the far side. They did not accomplish their task. The Americans quickened their pace as some British soldiers fired a few harmless random, possibly warning shots or blank cartridges. At about 9:30 that morning, as the leading Minutemen approached to within about 50 yards of the bridge, the light infantry fired a volley. A musket ball struck and killed Captain Davis instantly. After a split-second hesitation, Major Buttrick realized that the British were using ball ammunition, and he shouted, "Fire, fellow soldiers! For God's sakes, fire!" The command was repeated along the column as the men of the Acton Company returned the fire to their front and along the riverbank. Four of the eight British officers present, a sergeant, and four privates were wounded in the initial return fire. In another instant, one redcoat fell dead, and another was mortally wounded. Having believed they faced untrained amateurs who would flee rather than fight, the British regulars were stunned by the tenacity of the American militia. In contrast, many of the redcoats fired too high, ironically a characteristic common to less than well-trained soldiers. The volume of fire directed against them caused the light infantrymen to begin to break and run down the road toward Concord, despite the valiant but vain efforts of their officers to rally them. At the same time, Lieutenant Colonel Smith rode towards the bridge, leading two grenadier companies, the reinforcements he had promised Lorry. Buttrick of the Americans ordered the Minutemen who had crossed to the east side of the bridge to take cover behind the stone wall on the high ground a few hundred yards from the road. Smith restored order and reformed Lowry's three light infantry companies. Looking at the numbers of provincials on either side of the bridge, he assessed the situation. Word about the four companies with British officer Parsons, he was prepared to go to fight his way to their relief with the entire expeditionary force if necessary. Smith sent British runners to tell Major Pitcairn to cease the search and assemble all the companies near the Wright Tavern as he led the five British companies back from the bridge to join them. At about 10 that morning, Smith and Pitcairn climbed to the hill above the burial ground to survey the surrounding terrain with their spyglasses. They saw groups of Americans advancing towards the South Bridge, as well as British officer Parsons' men on the north bank marching at the double quick on the road to the North Bridge. With Americans positioned on the hills, the four companies trotted across the bridge, unnerved by the sight of dead and dying comrades. Remarkably, Barrett's and Buttrick's men of the Americans allowed them to pass unmolested to rejoin the rest of the British in Concord. With the Americans closing in and the entire command reunited, Smith knew it was time to leave. After thanking local doctors for their help, he left the severely wounded British in their care. Except for one soldier interred without ceremony, the dead were left behind for the townspeople to bury. Wounded British officers were loaded aboard impressed chaise, but the ambulatory enlisted casualties had to walk. American militia and Minutemen companies throughout the region had mustered and were marching to the scene of the action. Smith and his officers knew marching 700 tired soldiers 20 miles through a country infested with hostile American irregulars was to be no easy task. He ordered the light infantry companies to send skirmishers out for flank security, and the half-mile-long column began the sad retreat to Boston at about noon, marching silently without the accompanying sound of drum and fifes. The Americans allowed the British to march unmolested along the road towards Lexington for about 1 mile, with the troops from Concord in pursuit. When the British column reached the junction of the Lexington and Bedford roads called Merriam's Corner, militia and Minutemen companies, numbering between 500 and 600 men, took them under heavy fire from positions around the house, barn, outbuildings, and stone walls of the farm of Nathan and Abigail Merriam, about 100 yards from the road. As the column trudged along, climbing and descending hills and crossing streams, light infantry flankers did their valiant best to keep the American skirmishers from approaching the road to get in position for better shots. The British column moved as quickly as possible. The militia and Minutemen officers of the Americans led their companies through the brush and along the fields bordering the road, with the men frequently changing positions, and kept the redcoats under almost constant fire in a running gun battle. When the road turned left or north at Hardy's Hill, the British were subject to deadly fire from about 200 to 300 Americans firing from behind cover. The number of casualties mounted as places along the road became deadly, with names like the Bloody Angle. The fight was not all one-sided, though. At times, the British regulars were able to deliver effective volleys that took a toll on attacking Americans, while flankers achieved some success when they surprised and killed groups of Americans waiting in concealed positions. When the front of the marching column made the turn and crossed into the town limits of Lexington on the way back from Concord, the men of Parker's company were waiting in ambush to exact a measure of revenge for the unprovoked killing by the British of their townsmen earlier that morning. They opened fire into the staggering British column. About a dozen redcoats went down in the volley, including Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who fell from his horse with a painful thigh wound. Major Pitcairn of the British rode to the front of the column and sent grenadiers and light infantrymen to attack the flanks of Parker's ambuscade. The Lexington men withdrew after engaging in some bitter fighting. When the column halted, Americans pursuing from the bloody angle continued to torment the rear and center companies. Moving again, as the British approached a hill the local residents called the Bluff, Major Pitcairn of the British sent the company of Marines to hold it and prevent the swarming Americans from taking positions there as the column limped past. Not long after that ordeal, the British were taken by another blast of withering musket fire at an elevation called Fisk Hill. Pitcairn was thrown from his horse, which then deserted its rider. As the British troops ascended the last hill before entering Lexington, the companies lost cohesion until the heroic efforts of their officers reformed their ranks. Tired, hungry, dispirited, limping along, dragging their wounded with ammunition nearly exhausted, Smith's expedition reached the Lexington Green. Suddenly, the men in the rear heard cheers from the front of the column. On a hill east of the column, near Monroe's Tavern, stood a fresh brigade of about 1,000 British infantry in full array, supported by two pieces of artillery. General Gage had sent the reinforcements in response to Smith's request earlier in the day, when he first suspected there could be trouble with the Americans. Brigadier General U. Lord Percy had arrived to save Smith's shattered command. The men of the expedition staggered and stumbled to the area behind Percy's brigade and collapsed in exhaustion as the British field guns kept the pursuing American Minutemen at bay. The provincials regrouped as Brigadier General William Heath and Dr. Joseph Warren of the Americans arrived to assume control of the Massachusetts forces in the field. Unfortunately for the British Redcoats, the battle was not yet over. They still had to march 11 miles back to the safety of Boston. General Percy planned the retreat and placed Smith's battered companies in the lead, not expecting more trouble from the Americans. The wounded Lieutenant Colonel Smith was helped aboard a chaise for the trip. Flankers were ordered out, and the combined British force marched towards the town of Metomee, which is present-day Arlington, when they experienced another vicious firefight. As the Americans maintained the pressure, the Redcoats now took advantage of natural cover and stone walls, skirmishing not unlike their enemies as they withdrew. Unfortunately, some of the British troops also engaged in looting and plunder of private property, and they abused American civilians. As Lord Percy's column entered Cambridge, the general saw a regiment of Americans positioned to block the road to Boston in an attempt to force the British against the Charles River, militiamen having removed the planks of the bridges there and at Watertown. Instead, he had his men drive forward to Charlestown with the two artillery pieces in front, and the Americans withdrew, leaving the way open to the ferry to Boston. General Percy posted a rear guard on Bunker Hill to cover the retreat. Although reinforcements continued to arrive, American zeal had tapered off, and no further aggressive moves were made. General Percy evacuated the British casualties and Smith's exhausted soldiers to Boston first. The battle was over. It had cost the British 65 dead, 180 wounded, and 27 missing. The Americans suffered 50 dead, 39 wounded, and 5 missing. After the exchanges of musketry at Lexington and Concord, the British Army retreated into Boston, which became even more of an armed camp than it had been the day before. The Provincial Congress of the Massachusetts Bay Colony began forming a standing army in earnest and called on its neighbors Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New Hampshire to join in the struggle. As their militia soldiers responded to the alarm, a state of war now existed between the four colonies and the British government. The Army of Observation surrounded Boston and placed the British troops who occupied Boston under siege, but they needed help. They appealed to delegates who represented all 13 colonies to join them in the struggle for American liberty that should involve not only New England, but the entire continent. When the Second Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia on May 10th, the delegates soon learned that armed men commanded by Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold had captured the British forts at Ticonderoga in New York and Crown Point on Lake Champlain. The constitutional crisis, in which Americans sought a redress of grievances from the British King and Parliament, had transitioned into open hostilities. The delegates realized that even though many in the colonies desired reconciliation with the mother country, they would now have to address the new military situation. Congress took the next step that eventually transformed a local rebellion into a war for independence by establishing the Continental Army. On June 14, 1775, Congress resolved that six companies of expert riflemen be immediately raised in Pennsylvania, two in Maryland, and two in Virginia, and as soon as completed, shall march and join the army near Boston to be there employed as light infantry under the command of the chief officer in that army. The delegates then prescribed an oath of enlistment that required the new American soldiers to swear, "I have this day voluntarily enlisted myself as a soldier in the American Continental Army for 1 year unless sooner discharged, and I do bind myself to conform in all instances to such rules and regulations as are or shall be established for the government of the said army." The next day, Congress voted to appoint George Washington to command all the Continental forces and began laying the foundation for the American Army. On June 17th, the delegates of the United Colonies, reposing special trust and confidence in the patriotism, valor, conduct, and fidelity of George Washington, issued its first commission by appointing him General and Commander-in-Chief of the Army of the United Colonies and of all the forces now raised or to be raised by them, and of all others who shall voluntarily offer their services and join the defense of American liberty and for repelling every hostile invasion. The Revolutionary War had begun. This concludes campaign number one. Let it begin here, the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Campaign number two, the 14th Colony, the Quebec, Canada Campaign, June to December 1775. It took less than 1 month for the opening shots at Lexington and Concord to reverberate 300 miles away in Canada. Both history and geography suggested that the northern province would eventually become involved in the brewing imperial conflict. Until 1760, it had been a French possession, and as such, the wartime bane of the old English North American colonies. It had since become the British province of Quebec after Britain's French and Indian War conquest. Now, at the dawn of the Revolutionary War, London, England, saw similar opportunities there as a strategic North American base and source of manpower. The rebel colonies, however, saw a different prospect: to bring the Canadians into their continental cause and their struggle with the ministry in England. Yet despite Quebec's apparent proximity, it was both foreign and remote. Its nearly 100,000 inhabitants were predominantly French-speaking Catholics living along the colony's defining geographic feature, the St. Lawrence River. Since the St. Lawrence entered the Atlantic so far north, Quebec City was 1,000 sea miles from Boston, and the northern Appalachian Highlands partitioned Canada from New York and New England. Only the Lake Champlain-Richelieu River corridor readily connected them, the region's traditional route for trade and war. In early 1775, a small British garrison held the key military post on this path called Fort Ticonderoga. After Lexington and Concord, both Connecticut and Massachusetts recognized Ticonderoga's importance and launched separate covert efforts to seize it in New York. Under Connecticut's authority, Ethan Allen ventured forward with about 100 rough-and-tumble Green Mountain boys and a few dozen Western Massachusetts and Connecticut volunteers, while Massachusetts commissioned Benedict Arnold scouted the area as his men were being recruited to serve. The two parties encountered each other near their common target, and after some debate, Ethan Allen agreed to let Benedict Arnold join the imminent attack. On May 10, 1775, Ethan Allen's Green Mountain Boys surprised the British garrison at Ticonderoga and took the fort and its valuable artillery without a fight. The next day, they secured nearby Crown Point on Lake Champlain and additional cannon there. Benedict Arnold's orders gave him an additional objective, a British government sloop based 100 miles away across the Quebec border at Fort St. John's. That sloop was a key to naval control of Lake Champlain. So 5 days after taking Ticonderoga, Benedict Arnold led about 50 men north by boat. On May 18, 1775, Arnold's troops swept in on the fort, seized the British ship, and departed with supplies, guns, and 11 prisoners before the British in Montreal could react. Not to be outdone, Ethan Allen led about 90 Green Mountain Boys to occupy Fort St. John's. They approached Canada in small boats later that same day, even after Benedict Arnold discouraged their mission in an open lake meeting. When a British redcoat detachment came from Montreal that evening in a belated response to Benedict Arnold's raid, the Green Mountain Boys prudently re-embarked before there was a serious engagement and sailed back to Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain. On May 20th, word of the rebels' Fort St. John's raids and the capture of the sloop and the loss of Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain reached British Governor Guy Carleton in Quebec City. Carleton, as a province's military commander-in-chief, he would need to draw on military experience garnered in Great Britain's last two major wars. Carleton was challenged to defend Quebec with scant forces. One regular regiment was committed to four distant and remote Great Lake forts, leaving just two other regiments to defend the 300-mile colonized St. Lawrence Valley expanse. Since any substantial rebel attack would undoubtedly come along the Champlain Corridor, Carleton concentrated his troops to protect the border at Fort St. John's. Small detachments guarded Montreal, Quebec City, and Fort Chambly, 11 miles north of Fort St. John's. Internally, Carleton placed little confidence in Quebec's province's tenant farmer habitants, but liberal British policy changes had recently secured support from the Catholic Church and the French-Canadian elite. To buttress Canada against the spread of rebellion, the governor declared martial law on June 9th and attempted to reinstate the long-disbanded militia. He was disappointed but unsurprised when many rural parishes in Quebec blatantly resisted mobilization into the British Army, and city musters were half-hearted. About 50 French and Anglo-Canadian loyalists augmented the redcoats at Fort St. John's that summer. Carleton had another potential source of military power: the Indian Seven Nations of Canada, living in Catholic mission villages at strategic points along the St. Lawrence Valley. These Indians frequently allied with their French colonial neighbors in wartime and had terrified English frontier colonists over a century of episodic raiding. However, despite Carleton's repeated efforts to draw these village nations into alliance in the coming war with Britain, they considered themselves independent and pursued a loose general neutrality. Individual warriors were free to fight as they wished, though, and a few joined the British at Fort St. John's, while others cooperated with the Americans. When the Congress established its Continental Army in June 1775, it carved out a northern department to protect the New York and New England frontiers, even though the army was concentrated in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That summer, intelligence from Quebec accurately reflected British military weakness and Canadian sentiments. but reports on Seven Nation Indians' intentions remain confusing and contradictory. On June 27th, a seemingly authoritative report warned that the Canadian Indians had taken up the hatchet with Carleton of the British, and the Continental Congress interpreted that as an indication that the British were preparing to attack from the north. So that day, Congress gave Major General Philip Schuyler authority to lead the Northern Army into Quebec as necessary for the peace and security of the colonies. There was a key constraint, though. He should only evade if it would not be disagreeable to the Canadians. British forces were the enemy, not the province's inhabitants. As a commander, Major General Schuyler's skills favored strategic organization and civil-military coordination. He was accustomed to leading through family position and elite connections as a landed New York patrician, but he'd also had vital logistics experience from the French and Indian War. His deputy, Brigadier General Richard Montgomery, brought field combat experience as a former British Army captain. Montgomery had moved to America just a few years earlier and married into another prominent New York family, the Livingstons, prompting his quick rise in patriot politics and military rank. When Schuyler arrived to command his army at Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain on July 18th, he found just two regiments, and he lacked the intelligence, supplies, and watercraft necessary to venture into Canada. While waiting for logistics to flow north and additional Connecticut and New York regiments to arrive, Schuyler sent scout parties into Quebec, relying heavily on Massachusetts Mayor John Brown. Reading from the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, Campaign Number 2, the Quebec-Canada Campaign, will continue. This is Wallace Klunkhurst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.